From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
All right, folks. All right. We're in the second hour, this live broadcast. Thank you for rejoining us. And very interesting developments, of course, in the U.S. politically. You know, just to round out that analysis, you know, Donald Trump, there's a couple of other cases that they've got lined up for this guy. The other one is Georgia. I suppose it's like election meddling or something to that effect. There's not much there. Apparently, there was a phone call. They said Trump needs to find me 11,780 votes. And they're saying, oh, that's election rigging by Trump, and he's abusing his power, blah, blah, blah. No, but taken out of context, of course, is that quote. And then when you go and read the full transcript, you realize this was just basically Trump doing his election strategy and basically saying, well, you know, we need to basically flush out our Republican voters there. There has to be margins that we can get and that we can win. And making accusations of election fraud by the other side is not illegal, despite what a lot of people would like to believe on the Democratic side, on the mainstream, hysterical mainstream media side, and the people who basically shut down any of this talk on social media. These are all the sort of guardians of speech and election integrity, as it's called. They think that questioning or raising doubt about elections in the U.S. is akin to some sort of a felony. Yeah, it might be in communist China or, you know, Soviet Russia, but not in America. I'm sorry. The facts will stand as they may. You're allowed to challenge anything you want. Okay. They're saying, oh, but the insurrection. Okay, whatever. This was long before that. And it wasn't an insurrection. Let's call it selfie gate. None of the buffalo horned people were ever going to overthrow the U.S. government, you know, most powerful country in the world. If you thought so, if anybody's positing that, then America's not very powerful, is it? They couldn't even overthrow a small, you know, they couldn't even overthrow Andorra. And it doesn't get much smaller than that. In fact, San Marino, half the size of a football field. The J6 crowd could not even overthrow the government of San Marino. Okay, look it up. World's smallest country. At least, or just about the world's smallest country. So anyway, we're going off on a tangent here. So the Georgia case, Trump, that's a non-starter. Nothing will stick there. The 2020 election and Capitol riot, nothing there. Nothing there. They've got a special counsel, Jack Smith. Again, Merrick Garland, fishing expedition. No, Donald Trump did not cause a Capitol riot, and there was no insurrection or attempted overthrow of the U.S. government. Get out of town and never come back. New York civil cases, of which there are many for Trump. This is Letitia James, the attorney general of New York, who campaigned on she was going to get Trump and the Trump organization, et cetera, all sorts of process crimes here. That's endless. It'll keep going. Plus another E. Jean Carroll potential libel suit, defamation suit. You know, what is the big one? What's the big fish? Is it the documents? That's the question. We don't know. Is it the hush money with Stormy Daniels? Nope, that's not going anywhere. That one can be appealed into the next decade. So nothing happening there. So really, it looks like this document is the big one. In the words of Fred Sanford, this is the big one. So this could be the big one. So if it's the big one, there's, again, nothing there. I don't see anything in this document scandal that rises to any kind of a crime, much less a felony. This is lawfare. And, wow, you know, this is just being done openly still. The derangement reaction to Donald Trump still persists after all of these years. It's incredible. These people just haven't gotten over it. They don't want to get over it. They don't like the fact that the deplorables have chosen somebody who is not from the machine. It's as simple as that. And they do not want to accept any other outsiders ever to occupy any significant offices of any consequence, much less the president of the United States of America. But Trump did it. He did it for a term. How he survived is a small miracle in itself. If he comes back to run and gets a nomination, there is a good chance that he will win the presidency. And yeah, and that's the second term. He will not be hamstrung. If Trump gets in, it's scorched earth. He's going to replace the FBI director out. He will handpick one of his guys, even if it's like Devin Nunes. I don't know. But it's all going to be loyalists there. CIA out. FBI out. DHS out. DOJ, Attorney General, out. He's not going to give a damn. They can, if the Republicans have majority in the House, there's going to be no impeachment. So that's it. The swamp will be drained, at least part of the way anyway. You can only drain it so much before you need to clean out the drains themselves. But you could probably take a dent out of the swamp in the probably in the first 24 months of his second term. So, and again, he doesn't have to worry about, you know, maybe there's a Senate confirmation hurdle, but Republicans, there's 30 seats available, 30 plus seats. Republicans take a few of these. They could easily get a 4-seat majority in the Senate if they're working it. And then what? Well, then there's going to be no impeachment. There's nothing to throttle Trump in a second term. It's going to be MAGA all the way, and that's it. So deal with it. That's what they're scared of. This is why they're going all out. They know this is make or break, that this evil cabal will be crushed, in a Trump second term. I'm not invoking any QAnon spirits here, or I am not in La La Land. I'm telling you like it is. The first term is a very different thing than the second term. And now that Trump and those who are loyalists know what they're dealing with, which is absolute putrid evil and total partisan hysteria and derangement, they will not mess around and trying to play nice. It's not going to happen. And the media will be bludgeoned into position in the way that they should have been in his first term. And that's what's going to happen. And the deep state, well, they'll do what they're going to do. I don't know. I don't know what the deep state will do with a Trump victory. I would say Donald would be on sort of, you know, assassination watch if that happened. That's not an exaggeration. You're dealing with an absolutely feckless mob and some of the most corrupt individuals ever to slither through the halls of government. I think they should fire the entire senior executive service, sack them all, every single last one of them. Actually get rid of the SES. That's the deep state, by the way. If you're listening, have you ever heard of the senior executive service? No, you haven't. Most people haven't. That's the deep state. That's the permanent state. That's the top echelon of every federal agency and other people who achieve SES status, okay? People like Peter Schrock and all these corrupt bureaucrats and ideologues that are permanently embedded in the FBI, all the various realms of the civil service, all the federal agencies, all these people. They're permanently in there. They've got pensions that are just ungodly. And that's the problem. This is not a democracy. It's a kakistocracy, or however you pronounce it. That's what we've got. I'd get rid of the senior executive service. Just fire them all. Just executive order, get rid of it. And if you want to have entrenched bureaucrats, well, there has to be some terms and conditions for this. One of them is there's going to have to be some limits on how long you can be an embedded boll weevil in the federal government. There has to be limits. You cannot have these people running things from behind the scenes because, unfortunately, they've accumulated amongst a certain type of ideological individual and partisan, a certain partisan bent. They've been allowed to accumulate. It's completely lopsided. We cannot dislodge any of these creatures from the swamp. They're permanent. They have burrowed in, nestled in. They've built their encampments and built up their various berms, and they're sort of defending their positions from behind some sort of fortifications, bureaucratic fortifications, and they are completely self-serving. Our democracy has been captured by these super bureaucrats and also by lobbyists. Corporate lobbyists have bought and hijacked, and basically they have owned our elections to the point where you can't run for anything. You can't have any individual or unique points of view on anything. If you do, literally that machine, that corporate lobby machine, all that money will go to the person that you're running against. They will buy them off. In the rare exception where both candidates are unique and have independent viewpoints, which is like literally winning the Powerball, okay, one in a billion. Not going to happen, generally not in that case. Otherwise, you know, either toe the line and you get in, or you don't toe the line and the guy next to you gets in. And the people with the money decide how that whole game goes. They'll come up to you and they say, we really like you. You got a lot of talent. We like your views, but, you know, you got to, you know, moderate your position there on Israel. Otherwise, we're going to go to Fred over there, the guy you're running against. We're going to back him and you're out. You're finished. We'll bury you. It's as simple as that. Fred's not as talented as you are, John, or James or whatever, but, you know, we're going to go with him because his position on Israel and his position on green energy and his position on Russia, that's what we want. And we're the deep state. We're the corporate state. We run this show. And you either get on board with the program or go find another career, because it certainly ain't going to be politics. That's how things really work in Washington. And to some degree at a state level as well. So unfortunately, that's not a democracy. It's not. That democracy left the building a long time ago. To drain this swamp, take some extreme measures. The people truly want to take their country back. They truly want to take their system back. It is going to take some extreme measures. And you need a populist executive to make it happen. Otherwise, there's no chance. Ain't going to be Ron DeSantis, okay? Ain't going to, definitely not going to be Joe Biden. And maybe Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is making some good noises, but, you know, if he gets too close to the promised land, they're going to, you know, they'll get a hold of him and they will move him in the correct direction. And he will have to, let's say, adapt his positions in order to be given a chance at a seat at the table. Not even the seat at the table, just given a chance at the seat at the table. The pressure will be immense. Unless Robert F. Kennedy can become and transform himself into a true populist, that means absolutely no foreign interventions. And also, you're going to have to be responsive to what the people are saying, not just what party they're from. But what are the people of America saying? That'll be a true populist. We'll see how things shake out. Let's take a break here with TNT, Today's News Talk, and we will now go down onto the ground and find out what's really happening with this so-called counteroffensive that has been hyped for months now. The spring offensive is finally here, but wait, it's summer. They're a bit late, and more on this on the other side. I'm Patrick Henningsen. This is TNT, Today's News Talk. We'll be right back.
You should hear what Dirk Pohlman is talking about.
You can see immediately what you're describing because the doctors in our world have laboratory white coats, and that shows the distance that they have to the object of their science. That is not being as close as possible, not what you describe being in a communicative possibility, but rather with a white coat to show that there's an object and you're treated scientifically without feeling, really. And it's also that in a way that we pay doctors, we go to doctors and pay them when we're sick, whereas it would be more interesting to have it the Chinese style where you pay as long as you're healthy and the purpose is to keep you healthy. So, and that also in a third part reminds me of the way of communication, which was in the COVID situation became like warfare and became very totalitarian from the state side. But this is what brought me, in the beginning for me it was a scientific topic, but I disliked very soon how everything constitutional was not constitutional, which means don't touch it, but became something like a fair weather story. If it starts to rain, it's not valid anymore.
The Dirk Pohlman Show on Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
When you can point me to an industry, to a platform that reaches 250 million people a month, virtually 9 out of 10 Americans. That's real. That's substantive. That's important. and that reach and that touch point and that daily reinforcement. It's an amazing place to be able to communicate messages. That's massive.
To find out more, go to tntradio.live. Patrick Henningsen talks on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to TNT. Today's News Talk, I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Thank you for rejoining us for this second hour. And we're going to do the hard pivot over to the big story, the big event, the conflict in Ukraine. And what we've heard in the last 72 hours is that the much-anticipated counteroffensive has finally begun. They've been hyping it. They've been foreshadowing it. They've been baiting us all over the world. Ukraine has about this imminent counteroffensive. The spring offensive is coming. Well, here we are in the summer, and the spring offensive has finally arrived. The question is, how successful are the Ukrainian forces? There's a lot riding on this, not to mention the public opinion and support of pretty much everybody in the West for this proxy war. And to help us elucidate some of these questions is international human rights lawyer Arno Devole. He's been on the program before. He is on the ground in this part of the world, and hopefully we can get a honest assessment from Arno on the true state of affairs. Hello, Arno. How are you?
Hello, Patrick. How are you?
I'm all right. We're doing okay here. How are you guys doing over there? How is the state of the people, the mood, the situation in Russia?
Well, we could say that somewhat people have settled in the routine of hearing about a conflict going on about, let's say, 300, 400 kilometers east, but not really being quite affected in their routine, daily basis routine, save for the recent drone attack on, and I said drone attack, quote unquote, on Moscow. A couple of weeks ago, we had about 33 drones, which were, you know, sighted over Moscow, and most of them were neutralized by Moscow air defense. Few of them crashed into residential buildings. Some material damage, but no injured, thankfully. So this is pretty much the mood here. People are just going about their activities, and the conflict somewhat seems remote, to be honest.
And how about the much anticipated counteroffensive? This is, it's like all the chips are stacked on this. Everybody's been hyping it up for months. It hasn't arrived. Now we're told it's here. And do you have any idea of the initial results of this? Certainly, there's a lot of activity around the Zaporizhia area. There's a number of insertion points along this wide front line against the Russian Federation forces by Ukrainian armed forces. What have you heard so far? What's your impressions so far, Arno?
Well, interestingly enough, the mounted counteroffensive already earned its nickname here. It's called the Banzai counteroffensive, somewhat ridiculed, or as it were. Not so much for the fact that people are dying, to be sure, but for the fact that we seem to be witnessing something almost eerily echoing what has been going on the last 6 months in Bakhmut, i.e. Ukrainian forces throwing manpower into a kind of aimless assault on very fortified Russian defenses. And as they try to somewhat force their way through what they call focus point on some of the defensive lines, the Russian armed forces are basically tearing them to pieces, using drones, using artillery pieces, using air force. so far we have numbers along the lines of a couple of thousand casualties on the Ukrainian side, and there was about 5 Leopard 2 tanks taken out, about 4 Bradley armored transport troop armored vehicles, about the same number as far as Dutch transport troop armored vehicle as well, and lots of artillery set pieces and what they call the automated cannon taken out, literally taken out, with this kind of situation, which is completely eerie, as some of the tanks that were actually brought in were brought in from areas, desert areas, desert-like theater of operation. And it would appear that for some reason, the Ukrainian headquarters, central command, completely decided to forego repainting those vehicles and all those tanks to adopt the more greenish, olivish, tone of the Ukrainian spring colored theater. And so this makes it for easy picking, in other words. And it's really, pretty much the mountain that turns into a mice, this kind of offensive so far. And so what we tend to be more concerned about, though, is this, obviously, the blowing up of the dam near the Kherson area. 14,000 people were evacuated. This is shaping up to be an ecological disaster and bearing on the agricultural, side effect, consequences on the ability to harvest food. The infrastructure is going to be obviously in need of a complete overhaul. And there's been rumor also that this could have, some incidents on the cooling of the nuclear reactor in Zaporozhye, nuclear power plant. To which you would add the blowing up of this ammonia line, gas line, which in terms of fertilizer was relied upon substantially in the context of the implementation of this grain deal. So that somewhat, throws a wrench in this process, which again, affects, we would assume, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people around the world in the countries where, they need it the most. So this is actually, to me, the quite worrying aspect is, and I'm not mentioning all those shelling in Golovka, for instance, of, again, civilian areas completely unrelated to any kind of military value as such. And so we seem to be seeing a regime in Kiev in complete disarray. We understand that some of the soldiers that were captured seem to be completely demotivated, almost resigned to their fate. And so once you get through the initial gloss of again, this vaunted counteroffensive gets coined on the social network and on the information telegram channels, you get the feeling that their heart is not in it anymore, and that there's obviously more cynical plays going on behind the scenes, mostly in Washington, who obviously for political reasons needed and urged Zelensky to trigger this kind of offensive, no matter what, no matter the cost. And the idea also is that we have this NATO summit slated to take place in Vilnius on July 11th. And obviously, the Ukraine membership is going to be front and center, but we just heard from the U.S. ambassador to NATO that this membership of Ukraine into NATO was out of the question. And so we seem to be somewhat slowly but surely heading into some kind of PSYOP towards some of the NATO member on the eastern flank of the alliance, whereupon something would be somewhat taken into account that since Ukraine will not be gaining NATO membership, but that something somewhat has to be done to support Ukraine, there might be the possibility of creating this coalition of the willing redux that we had in 2003. And this is kind of the word being peddled around right now, that there might be a possibility to put together some kind of posse of countries, i.e. most likely the Baltic states and Poland, who might, you know, notwithstanding the internal functioning statutes of NATO, join the fray and provide manpower on the ground. This is what seems to be shaping up right now.
Well, that's definitely dovetails with a statement by former NATO head Anders Rasmussen. He mentioned this a couple of days ago in the media, saying NATO countries might be having to, you know, contribute some soldiers into the fight. I mean, that just transforms everything, Arno, because on two levels, one of them is they can't claim that they're not directly in conflict with Russia at that point. The other thing is that not an admission that you're losing, that the proxy war, everything that's been thrown in there has been a failure? That they now have to, you know, NATO countries have to pony up and to create a coalition of the willing just to keep the war going. There's no guarantee that these soldiers are going to, you know, A, make a difference, and B, you know, survive if they're fighting on the front lines. I mean, I can see them way behind the front lines, Arno, but what do you think the public reaction will be in the West if a lot of these soldiers start turning up dead? I don't think it's going to be a very favorable one.
Well, it's difficult to foresee what might happen. Basically, the rules are obviously there to be broken or to be somewhat shaped and bent to the political will of the moment. And to the extent things might be presented as a spontaneous coalition of the willing operating strictly out of NATO guidelines, to the extent we get into a situation of frontal head-to-head confrontation between Russian armed forces and some of those NATO members from on the eastern flank of the alliance, what tells us that we may not be finding ourselves in an Article 5 situation, you know, owing to the media, obviously, hyping the situation and trying to impute to Russia, you know, a desire to go way beyond the Ukrainian operation and taking on NATO, you know, basically as an organization. Not to mention the fact that the organization itself is on life support. I mean, it has no legitimacy. It yearns for more budget, so it is on a mission creep mode. But to the extent everything that's been attempted, as you underlined, thus far has come to be an utter failure, they might need to double down in a way that we've never seen before to kind of save the day and their careers in the process. And so this is a very, very dangerous game. Obviously, you know, tempers have to be somewhat restrained, but it's almost like a Mexican standoff here where, you know, it's you made your move, you threw everything you had at me, including the kitchen sink, and obviously I'm not budging. If anything, I'm consolidating my position, and more than ever before, in the context of a peace negotiation, I have no reason to compromise that much, whereas at least as compared to the situation as it might have been before the start of the military special operation. So It's really a situation now where, in terms of perception management, NATO needs somewhat to score something big, and but to what extent are they going to do it? This remains to be seen, and this could be the ground for miscalculation.
Yeah, I think so. It's a lot of risks involved here, Arno. It really is. And so I'm looking at the numbers here. It's very difficult to get accurate figures real time. But what I've been doing, through the course of this conflict is doing kind of averages, looking at the detailed reports coming out of the Russian MOD. And I'm also cross-referencing this with a number of Russian Telegram channels, including Rybar. And what we found is they tend to make sense. These numbers consistently have been echoed by credible commentators on social media, on YouTube, like Colonel Douglas McGregor, like Scott Ritter, and so forth. So what we have, 30,000 men over 6 insertion points on the Ukrainian side, the majority of activity around the Zaporizhia area. And the numbers thus far in the first 72 hours, or actually 4 days now, fourth day, 8,700 dead, 2,900, quote, missing soldiers, 4,000 hospitalized, over 60 tanks, including German Leopard tanks, which we have video of that was actually published by German media, by Bild newspaper. And 66 plus, maybe more, combat vehicles of various descriptions, 30 howitzer gun units, 4 or maybe more, actually 6 fixed-wing aircraft. So those are the Ukrainian losses in the first 3 to 4 days, Arno. This is not a good start for the counteroffensive. What are your thoughts?
Well, I would say it's catastrophic, actually, and if you add to this the fact that they could not even provide themselves the opportunity to consolidate their initial foray and or reach the first Russian line of defenses beyond beyond the contact line. It is, after 4 days, well, no pun intended, a Berezina.
Yeah. And on the total number of deployment behind the lines there on the Ukrainian side, 50,000. So just on that 30,000, that's half, 50% losses in 4 days, Arno. And if we count the full complement of 50,000 across all of the different frontline areas, if this continues at this rate, the Ukrainian forces could be severely degraded. And here's the problem, Arno. A lot of these would be the trained up soldiers that have been getting special NATO training for the last 2 months that we've heard about. And that number in something like 15 to 20,000 at least being trained to NATO specification for all this new equipment, et cetera. So, I mean, where are they going to, doesn't matter how many tanks they have, Arno. If they're missing, they've been trained on the Leopards and there's no one, they have 20 Leopards there and they don't have anybody to actually man them. Then there's the Ukrainian armed forces are basically dead in the water. I mean, they can't carry on. I really think it's a fait accompli that I really do not see how they have a path forward to anything even remotely resembling even a partial victory here. Then that's what you said before, Arno, is very likely to happen, is NATO has only a few desperate moves left or a diplomatic move. What do you think the options are and the chances are of seeing any diplomacy in the next couple of months?
Well, we know there's this Chinese plan, that's been kind of floated around, but obviously the decision will depend on the political situation in Washington. And obviously, the Biden administration needed some kind of tangible, quote-unquote, win to, regain the momentum. I mean, we're dealing with administration in, in complete delinquents, and it's free falling in the polls. You had to this the amplification of the scandals surrounding the Bidens in Ukraine, with this House Judiciary Oversight Committee just basically smelling blood in the water. We had the FBI dragging their feet on providing the document which would evidence-shape the bribing of the Biden father and son to the tune of $5 million. Almost at the same time, simultaneously, they are going after Trump. We just heard the announcement today that they had issued an indictment, federal indictment this time against him. So they are weaponizing the Justice Department. They are weaponizing the FBI. And this also is, to me, very worrying, because it looks to me that the U.S. administration is backed against the wall. They're going desperate. There's still a long way to go. The polls are not looking good at all. And, you know, this Ukraine thing was kind of like the only game in town for them. And to the extent they were expecting, even with all the media hoopla behind it, for the last 4 months, you know, hyping this counteroffensive and trying to basically rally their, you know, support in Europe, at least in as far as some of the staunchest NATO members, that this was, you know, something that was worthy and that deserving of being pursued. The fact that in 4 days, as you mentioned, I mean, we're witnessing a complete, you know, it's a shooting gallery out there. And you know, what we're seeing essentially is that Ukraine does not have the military capabilities to make a dent in the Russian lines. And it's just more and more meat grinder. And at some point, this is going to become a mere matter of arithmetics. And the equipment cannot arrive fast enough. The training cannot be distillated fast enough. The coordination between the different corps, whether it's the ground forces or, you know, the Air Force, to the extent they have an Air Force. I mean, they can't even get F-16s, which by definition are not the most advanced fighter planes out there. Far from it. I'm sure the Su-35, Russian Su-35, would make, quick work of them. They still have to somewhat take the time to train the pilot. Now we hear that Belgium does not want to be the ground where those pilots will be trained. It's just starting to look really bad all around. This is pretty much, what I'm getting here. And, there's a long way to go for, again, a U.S. administration which is supposed to provide guidance and a vision as to what this whole project is about. And it is feeling itself embroiled increasingly on the domestic front.
So much of this, Arno, has been public relations. All these various announcements, these weapons are coming. We're training these people over here. We're getting them ready for the big counteroffensive. It's almost like there's been a whole public relations program that's been rolled out for like the last, let's say, 3 months. And the to keep the public in the West interested, to keep the politicians feeling like they've still got a chance, and to keep the money flowing, and also to keep the media kind of on side, because, you know, there's a risk, of course, in some countries that the media may start questioning or slowly turning against government on this. At the moment, everybody's still kind of on board with it. But I do feel like, Arno, you may have noticed this as well, some publications like The Economist, and, you know, they're starting to hedge a little bit. Even CNN, the fake news network, is hedging a little bit, saying, the Ukrainians have met stiff resistance from the Russians. They're taking losses. I mean, all these things were totally verboten. You weren't allowed to say taking losses or, you know, anything negative at all, because it like hurts the war effort. And we're even starting to see the media in the West kind of hedging a little bit, Arno. This is, I think this is a dangerous area for the political people that have sunk their entire reputations on this conflict. Your thoughts?
Well, indeed, I agree. And if you add to this, the latest number for the Eurozone just came out, and they are not good at all. We are technically in a recession, which actually could have been a lot worse if not for the fact that last winter was somewhat smooth, a mild winter. But, owing to the rising cost of energy, the moving out of major companies now because of the cost of doing business, there's really no silver lining for European politicians to look forward to. You add to this the complete political dearth of quality leadership in all the main countries, at least in as far as the UK, Germany, and France is concerned, and we're basically in presence of a slow rotting process, which has no outcome, no light at the end of the tunnel. And this is where it gets really dangerous, because obviously the masses, the people, are going to be increasingly exacerbated by this constant coverage about the Ukraine being in need of fundings and weapons, when some of the most basic needs of the indigenous people of those countries are seemingly being completely neglected. This makes for a very dangerous combination.
And also, I'm also seeing there's a little bit of a fissure going on with regards to Poland. I know I saw recent reports that there was some talk among U.S. Interests to be careful with Poland and not to get sucked into Poland's extreme partisan positions, especially regarding this war. So again, it would have been nice to see this happen earlier, Arno, but it's happening now. So people are basically saying all these things that were unsayable before, which is that, hey, there's all these various pitfalls are now being kind of vocalized in different parts of the media. And what I see, Arno, here is a bunch of, the excuses are being laid out that possibly like a buffet that politicians could be able to select from various excuses in order to take a step back a little bit, or to take a slightly more cautious position on this conflict. And that's what I see happening right now. Arno, it's going to have to take a major European leader to be a dissenter on this. That's the only way I can see the whole constellation of interest on this shift on this. There has to be. I don't think it's going to come from the U.S. Not in the short term. It's got to be from some European country or NATO member. That's the only way I see it, Arno.
Well, one could expect some kind of reprieve to come out of Europe, but if the Hungarian episode is any indication, this will be difficult. I mean, Hungary is slated to take the presidency of the European Union on July 1st. And obviously, Orban has been extremely vocal about his reticence to support the Ukraine regime and to participate in the sanctions against Russia. And what we see now is that Brussels is basically tweaking its own rules to try to prevent Hungary from assuming the presidency of the European Union. This is kind of a positive sign, but to the extent institutional changes are slow to provide a concrete result, i.e. some kind of breakaway from the Union, we might be running out of time, because the Ukraine situation is evolving extremely rapidly. And to your point, to the extent that media are somewhat starting on the edges to edge their bets, aren't they doing it, too slowly? I mean, is that a qualitative reevaluation of the situation? Are they conceding that the starting point should be basically to really start having serious discussion on the status of Ukraine in the emerging European security architecture. So far, I'm not hearing anything along those lines. And I'm sorry to say, but I think short of those kind of thematics being broached, we are one buck too short, one day too late here.
Yeah, I think you're right, Arno. I think you're right. And the way this is developing right now, there can only be two likely outcomes. One of them is a desperate move by the West, by NATO, some kind of a game-changing move. Was that move the blowing of this dam? Did they hope that there would be some advantage that they could, or will there be some advantage that they can leverage as a result of this going forward? Black Sea provocation, perhaps. It's very difficult to say, but we have a couple minutes left. And what are the general impressions in Russia of the dam that's exploded? Do they feel like this is a potential problem for Crimea, or what are some of the concerns being raised? Certainly, it seems like the evidence suggests this is a Ukrainian or a NATO operation, simply because it had been targeted previously by Ukrainian forces with U.S. weapons, etc. So this has been an ongoing issue. But are there real concerns about this particular incident?
Well, with everything that basically defines the Russian establishment approach to such events, which is somewhat poised and understated. I mean, the idea that you don't want to project any kind of panic to the public. I would not be surprised if there weren't at least some sources of concern, because when you are dealing with basically a regime which is but the projection of an entire Western establishment which has lost its compass altogether, we get into irrational policies. And I think the blowing up of that dam is an expression of this irrational, if not depression, of the West and in general, and Ukraine in particular. And so could this be a harbinger of things to come? Would they be willing? Don't forget, we have neocons basically in charge of the Ukrainian project. And those people are so ideologically bent on being right in the end, at the end of the day, that the doubling down is something that you should definitely, keep in mind when it comes down to their way of organizing their next move. And so they might just basically try to obfuscate their responsibility because politically there will be a price to be paid. They can only hide behind their somewhat federal employee status for so long. At some point, if their project, their endeavor, their decade-long endeavor, as for the ultimate price, the dragging down of the entire economy of the country and leads to civil strife and political instability, it might be at some point presented as an option that some people have to take one for the team. And obviously the neocons, the federal employees at State Department, at the Pentagon, might be, pointed out, extracted, and somehow, presented to the public as the culprit, because somebody's got to take one for the team. This is how it works. Those are high-stake games. When everything goes well, everybody makes out well, but all it takes is, the plan to start going awry, and the rats basically fight over the last piece of cheese. And this is where the neocons are their most dangerous, is that they will never concede their failure. They will never concede defeat. It's for many of them a lifetime project. Many of them have dedicated their entire existence to what is transpiring right now in Ukraine. So how far are they willing to go? How much are they willing to raise the stakes? Would that include igniting a nuclear incident in the heart of Europe? I'm not excluding anything.
I'm not excluding anything either, but I think there's an interesting angle that you brought up there, Arno, and that is the neocons on this, on the the neoconservatives on the Republican side, because they're not, you know, technically in power, i.e., you know, it's not a Republican White House, it's a Democrat run White House, and you got senators like Bob Menendez and, you know, all these big time war hawks heading the committees on the Democrat side. It would be very easy, even though the neocons and you've got the Lindsey Grahams of the world and the kind of hysterical wing, war hawk wing of the Republicans, they could easily pivot and use this as in other words, they could be egging on a disaster that they think could sink the Democrats for good in the next election cycle. Okay. Now, if they did that, they would be able to step back and say they screwed up. They didn't manage it properly. They didn't give them enough weapons. You can imagine the sort of things that they'd be saying, or we didn't support them enough, Ukraine, or it was a miscalculation, da, da, da. So if that's the case, they could lay back and, of course, use this to sink the Democrats. The Republicans take power, and then they could very easily come and get into another arms race again with the Republican administration in power in the next, whoever that is, be it Trump or DeSantis or whatever. I think it's possible that this can be mismanaged, and they could easily create a winless quagmire for the Biden administration that could really damage the Democrats in a big, big way in this election cycle coming up over the next 12 months. That could be a game changer, because that's a losing issue for Democrats. But neocons could sit on the back, if you know what I mean, Arno, and then reposition their sort of whole shtick on this conflict, kind of reinvent themselves through the process of the failure of the Democrats, and then carry on with the war agenda, whatever that is, going forward. But I can see this could have U.S. domestic politics could come into play here. Your final thoughts on this?
Well, that's an interesting point. I would actually even go one further. I'm thinking that at some point, after throwing all that they've had at the Trump campaign, the Uni Party, as you know, they are casually called, they might actually look at the situation objectively and say, okay, this guy is inescapable. There's only that much we can do to sink him, short of creating the conditions of a civil war in the U.S. I mean, we are slowly but surely, you know, drifting into something akin to, you know, major structural problem within the U.S. if they keep piling it up on Trump. I mean, the guy seems to be, you know, taking everything in stride and emerging even stronger every time. But one thing Trump might be able or willing to concede is, going back to his anti-China trope, is to provide the deep state with some kind of a bargaining agreement where he would somehow beheading an effort to for an arms race in order to contain China. And so we might see a shift in theaters from Eastern Europe into the South China Sea, which obviously would be, you know, exchanging one type of poison for another. But to the extent the deep state gets to live another day, and the somewhat facade of political continuity gets maintained, this is something we could see. It's still very premature now. I mean, they're still thinking they can neutralize him. But I'm not completely, dropping the ball on this scenario. I'm thinking it might still be a possibility that, short of an open war with China, obviously, we get to see some kind of Cold War with this emerging player, which, let's make no mistake about it, the top economic rival of the United States, as perceived in Washington, D.C., is China. It is not Russia. So in that sense, that Republican neocon faction might actually be willing to reorganize their agenda and change the cast of characters in DC. And everybody would somewhat come out on top on this and preserve their interest. But the idea is we would see somewhat, you know, a dialing down of the crisis, you know, in Ukraine. Ukraine would be the subject of some kind of partitioning. Russia would be issued guarantees, security guarantees. But as soon as the next administration comes in, we could expect to see a ramping up of a Cold War with China. Yes.
Yeah. No, I agree. That's very, very likely. Very likely. Well, we'll see what that scenario really looks like in due course. But in the meantime, we'll keep our ears to the ground and our eyes on the field. Arno Devole, international human rights lawyer, we really appreciate your time with TNT Radio this week.
Thank you, Patrick. Always a pleasure.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. Arno Devole, and a big special thanks to our legal correspondent, Matthew Russell Lee, in New York at the Southern...